In a time before time, God breathed life into the universe, and the light gave birth to angels, and the earth gave birth to man, and the fire gave birth to the jinn, creatures condemned to dwell in the void between the worlds. One who wakes a jinn shall be given three wishes. Upon the granting of the third, the unholy legions of the jinn shall be freed upon the earth. Fear one thing only in all that is. Fear the jinn.
To make your wishes.
That was awesome. That was awesome. That's
oh,
great.
God.
That's great. Yeah. That's great. All right, let's get started. That was awesome. For anyone listening, this is the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. I am on the line with my good friend Ian Scheller, who has not been on the podcast in a very long time, but I'm happy to have him here now. My name is Christian Horn, as always, here on the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. Can I say Part-Time Fanboy Podcast enough in this intro? Probably not. But we are here because all through the month of October, Part-Time Fanboy has been picking, or members of Part-Time Fanboy have been picking horror movies to watch and go over and review and chat about on the podcast. And this week was Ian's pick. So far, the most interesting in a way pick, but it was Ian's pick. Why don't you tell people what you picked, Ian, for your horror movie pick?
Well, Christian, I chose Wishmaster.
Yes.
I believe produced by Wes Craven, directed by, was it Robert?
Kurtzman.
No. Kurtzman.
Yes.
Is that the right?
Yes, okay. Robert Kurtzman. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and this was, so I'm not a horror movie fan at all. Horror movies I like to watch are, I did enjoy the Chucky movies. I thought those were great.
Oh, really? And you watch The Walking Dead. I mean, do you still watch it? Or?
Yeah, I don't qualify it as horror, actually. I know it's a zombie thing, but, you know, I've never really seen Midnight on Elm Street or Friday the 13th.
You mean Nightmare on Elm Street?
Yeah.
Or
Halloween.
You've never seen those, like, ever?
No, not ever. Because I get really just awful, awful nightmares. And for whatever reason, when I was in Syracuse senior year, both me and my roommate, one of my roommates, had Fridays off, totally off. So we'd wake up, we'd smoke cigarettes, I would juice, I would make fresh strawberry juice.
Okay.
And we'd have to go figure. And then we would just go to the Carousel Mall, which is one of the biggest malls in Syracuse, New York. And we would just go see whatever was out. And, you know, 1998 to 1999, this is 97 this came out. This movie kind of just falls into that time where we were just going to the mall to see a bunch of stuff. And I remember we just were like, let's go see Wishmaster, and not knowing what to expect. Now, I know you had some hesitation, correct?
I did. But it's interesting because, I mean, A, you know, it's like you're not a horror fan. So, and you were just like, and I remember in the chain of emails, you were like, how about Wishmaster? And I was like, I don't know what that is. And, well, first of all, I didn't know what it is. Well, I knew it was something, and I knew it was something that I had sort of understood as being like sort of maybe a low budget or cheesy thing.
Right.
And It's really funny because I really feel like after having watched it, a lot of my preconceived notions of the movie have really changed a lot.
Yeah, I'm glad.
Because I mean, I don't particularly think like it's frightening or scary, but I'm just going to say it out in the beginning. I actually kind of like this movie. I enjoyed it. Like, yeah. And not in a sort of like mocking it or laughing at it or thinking it's right. silly. I mean, there is silly stuff in there and stuff, but there's something that I really enjoyed. And it's really funny because, Jay Holtham and I, 2 weeks ago, we talked about Prince of Darkness. And I have to say that, like, John Carpenter's Prince of Darkness, and I did not like that movie at all. I mean, I've seen it twice, and both times I just was kind of bored, and it just didn't, you know, strike me. You know, Jay liked it. But this movie, this sort of experience, I'm not going to say it's better than Prince of Darkness, because Prince of Darkness right. has some elements that are really well done, but I enjoyed watching it more than Prince of Darkness for a lot of reasons. Mm-hmm. It's just really interesting.
Good. Yeah, it was great to rewatch it, honestly. And I didn't remember all of it, but I remembered some of the funnier stuff. I guess after reading about it, you know, there's a lot of cameos in this movie by, you know, from some pretty amazing actors who did horror.
Yeah, yeah.
Robert Englund. Also, you know, the voice of Angus Scrimm, who was the voice, I think, from, was it Poltergeist?
Oh, really?
Yeah, Angus Scrimm. I have the IMDb open here.
Yeah.
Phantasm. He was the Phantasm. Tall man in Phantasm.
I have not seen that either. I have not seen that either,
although that's supposed to be a classic. But so he was the voiceover in the beginning. You know, you have the gentleman, Tony Todd, who was Candyman, had a nice cameo.
Which I have seen a long time ago.
Never saw that one. And, of course, Robert Englund.
Yeah, yeah. And Ted Raimi, Sam Raimi's brother, is in it.
Exactly. Yeah, I see him here too. Yeah. So there's all up and down the cast. There's just tons of tie-ins. If you're a diehard horror fan, it's sort of an insider's horror movie. It looks like, in a way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, but rewatching it, I was shocked because I'm like, you know, for what it is, a late '90s movie, I was like, I actually really enjoyed it, and I think the character of the djinn, or the djinn, this basically, which is an evil genie, for the most part, I really love the character. I really enjoyed the portrayal.
The actor
who portrays him, he could go from very educated and historical and almost philosophy-like into extremely just like modern and witty, and then just completely off color and belligerent.
All at the same
time, and it somehow works. I mean, what did you think of the Wishmaster himself? You know, the title creature of the movie.
Well, it's really funny. The first thing that I thought when I first laid eyes on him, I was like, this is like Matt Dillon and Patrick Warburton's man baby. Like, he is like the perfect combination of Matt Dillon and Patrick Warburton. And the second thing that struck me was, I was like, oh, he's very handsome. Like, I'm like, he's a good looking guy. Like, I was
really?
Like, they nailed it. Yeah, I thought he was a good looking guy. I thought he was like very good looking. I thought he was like very charming. I mean, you know, I was like, you know, he lays it on a bit thick, which, you know, he does.
He does.
He is very sort of like, it's funny, I should say, like, oh, he's very good looking. What I mean is, like, he's very good looking in that late 90s sort of way, you know, where he's got, like, the sort of perfectly cropped hair, and he's got, like, blue eyes, and he's in a suit, and it's part of the reason why I like this movie, and you know, the movie's 20 years old, which is crazy. Wow, this movie's 20 years old. But the thing is what I keep wondering, and my wife, I mean, I think that she thinks that this is the reason why I like this movie. There's sort of like a 90s nostalgia feel to this movie. Like, it made me feel nostalgic for the 90s, like when I used to watch like 90210 or Party of Five. Like, it has that sort of like weird 90s production quality that a lot of like these horror movies had, which is kind of, and not to insult the filmmakers anyway, but the cinematography is kind of flat. There's not a lot of like really interesting setups. You can tell that it's, I mean, I don't think that you can tell that it's cheap, but you can tell that it's not like super high budget. You know, it's very interesting, but Andrew Divoff, I guess is his name. And I guess he's Venezuelan. It says
he's Venezuelan and he is still, this guy works his butt off. He was just in a thing called Demons as the character Jasper Grant, but he has worked consistently since and before. I mean, Wishmaster, he was working tons of television, movies, and he's still going at it. He's nonstop here.
Yeah. And I thought he was really good in it. He laid on the like perfect level of cheese. It's really funny because he's sort of like, it's like he's trying to do Hannibal Lecter or something like that, or like really sort of like sinister, like, I'm just walking up to you and here I come, you know, Clarice or something like that. And it's just like very Alexandra, Alex, here I come, Alex, I'm coming to get you. You know, I mean, that stuff was great. I mean, he was great at it. And he's like, it's really funny because he's really a really good reason that the movie works as well as it does, you know? Because I think his portrayal, whenever he's on the screen, you're sort of looking at him and it's particularly when he's out of the makeup. I mean, when he's in the makeup, he does a really good job of like, of being able to sort of like push his essence outside of like the sort of makeup art that he's acting through. But I just thought he was like very charismatic. I thought he was fun to look at, and he just like very much encapsulated that sort of like 90s handsomeness that was all over TV, that was just all over like certain movies and stuff. And it was just like, he was like, I looked at him and I was like, if you took the male idea of like what media thought like was like a good leading man, like that's him, you know what I mean? Like, do you understand what I'm saying? Like, like the sort of like Fox Network leading man, like he would have been it, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I didn't think of that. I mean, but it is interesting what you say about the way it was shot. There's a lot of like, it is very flat. It's pretty brightly lit actually for a horror movie in a lot of scenes. And yeah, it looks like they shot it for around $5 million, but it made $15 million.
Yeah.
Which is pretty impressive, I would think.
I know,
that's not bad at all. And you know, the follow-ups they had made almost $16 million, but it looks like the follow-ups, you know, they had Wishmaster 2, 3, and 4, but they all went straight to DVD.
Video had never come out. Oh,
yeah. So, and he reprised the role in Wishmaster 2, Evil Never Dies, which, see, after watching this one, I'm tempted to go through
all of
them.
I really do want to watch at least two.
So he comes back, and then I think there's another guy who plays him in Wishmaster in 3 and 4, but
yeah, I have no interest. If Andrew Divoff is not in it, I don't want to see the others because was like a big draw for me.
I gotta say, I really enjoyed, and this was a surprise, I enjoyed Tammy Loren as a very kind of, I thought, unusual heroine in that she's a single, you know, young woman who's a gemologist, but is also like a dedicated basketball coach.
Yeah. Girls basketball coach. Yeah.
Like, I thought that wasn't your typical heroine. Like, you know what I mean? She was really strong throughout the movie, I thought, as far as the character. She was always either trying to make other people better, like through the basketball, and she was serious about her career, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
She wasn't just swept away by her boyfriend or her friend who was trying to become her boyfriend, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
And it was nice to kind of see that she didn't that character didn't fall into to a lot of stereotypes, in my opinion. I thought, you know, and was also interesting, too, is that this movie, much in the way a Japanese animation will give you, like, years of backstory. Do you remember the scene in the middle of the movie where her sister just gives the backstory of
The exposition?
Yeah, like, oh, you know, our parents were stuck in the house and you couldn't get to it. Was like, whoa, like, they just didn't even care to show you. They're just like, they're going to, you know, tell you that in a couple sentences. And I appreciated that.
That's good storytelling. I mean, it was interesting because that scene kind of came out of nowhere. The delivery from the actress was kind of forced a little bit. It was very much, you know, I mean, well, we should probably talk about like the story of the movie, but it was very sort of centered around the lead character sort of like blaming herself for her boyfriend or, you know, her friend, her best friend, getting killed. And her sister saying like, you know, it's not your fault. You can't make everything your fault. And her, you know, our parents died in the fire. You couldn't. You know, you got me out, but you couldn't get them out. That's not your fault, you know? And is like a really interesting bit of exposition. It's a bit forced, but you're right. Like it is very much sort of like, you know, they're sort of getting it out of the way. They say it in a couple of sentences. There's a little bit of sort of like a flashback, you know, scene.
Right.
And then we're sort of off to the races again. You know, they don't linger with that too much.
Yeah.
And they don't bring it up like over and over and over again. You know what I mean? Because I really expected the sort of like cheesy, like what wish would you like, Alex? And she's like, bring my parents back. You know, like that never happened. You know what I mean?
No.
And I found that really interesting because that would have been sort of like a very easy way to go. And I was like, oh, we're not going this way. We're not doing that.
Okay. Right.
Interesting. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's funny because you mentioned Tammy Lauren, the lead actress. I actually really liked her. And she's another one who just worked all the time in the 90s.
Yeah.
Just all the time in the 90s and like early 2000s. And seems to still be working every once in a while. It looks like she was on The Young and the Restless for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But it's funny. I liked her. My wife thought she was a bit miscast and maybe a bit too young for the part that she was playing, you know, like gemologist to sort of like be taken a bit, not to be taken seriously, you know, because she was a little too young looking. But there's a part of me that, you know, I felt like when the movie started off, and I'm really curious about the shooting schedule as far as this movie is concerned, because when the movie started off, she was really not good. And then her performance got much better as sort of the movie like went on. And then by the time you get to the end where she confronts, you know, the djinn or the genie, you know, I thought she was kind of like dead on. It's interesting. And the other thing that I noticed is I looked up, you know, this is produced by Wes Craven. This is 97.
Right.
And Scream came out in 96, which blows my mind.
Really? This was after Scream. I remember. Yeah.
And so it seems like Wes Craven was very much entering a phase of, and maybe not so much him, but maybe horror in general. Well, you know, horror has always been a genre where you have sort of like, maybe not always a strong female protagonist, but the survivor, you know, there's always the female survivor, the one that survives, the one that outwits the monster or the serial killer or whatever it is. And, you know, lives to tell the tale and, you know, walk off into the sunset, you know, and, pull herself away from the villain. But this, and along with Scream, I feel is very much Wes Craven sort of adding layers to his female leads. Like you said, giving them a life, giving them something to latch onto other than just the male lead, you know? And I really like that about this movie. It was, like you said early on, it was very different. And it just seems that Wes Craven or whoever, you know, the writer is Peter Atkins. I do not know who wrote Scream, but it seems like this type of horror, you know, this late 90s horror was very much venturing into, you know, we're not going to have her pop her top. You know, there's not going to be any explicit nudity. She's not going to be an object. She's going to be a character. And that was one of the things that I found really interesting.
Yeah, and also the other side of that, to have the Wishmaster going around and just effing with people, I found myself sometimes siding with Wishmaster.
Oh, no, why?
and being like, hey, you know, I wish I could do that too, you know what I mean? Just like people bother you, you know, you go, you know, it's very akin to Preacher, you know, stuff like that where – in a way. And I just got a kick out of the way he was like, in one scene, he's in the morgue taking the guy's like face off. And he tells the guy who comes in, he's like, you might not want to look at this. Like I'm defacing, you know, this corpse.
Yeah. 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 Love the way that the Wishmaster, the genie or whatever we're going to call him, I love the way that he, or they had him. I mean, you know, it's, the setup's a little awkward. It's not perfectly fluid. I think maybe in another filmmaker's hands, it might've been, better handled, but I love the way that he sort of sets them up every time, because they have to ask him for something, and he always sets it up to like where he makes them ask him a question, and he's like, "All right, here we go." You know what I mean? We're gonna do it. And then this is these just like horrible things. The one instance where I thought was a big fail was when he messes with Tony Todd, the Candyman.
So that was amazing on so many levels. But please, I'd like to hear your take on that.
There's a turn of phrase that he does. Like, wouldn't you like to sort of escape? Right. He says, wouldn't you like to escape or something like that?
Yeah.
And then he says, yeah, I would love to escape. Or he makes it sound like, you know, his life is boring. His life is dreary. And he says, wouldn't you like to escape? And he says, yeah, I would like to escape. And the next thing you see is Tony Todd in sort of like a Houdini-like, you know, compartment that's filled with water, and he's in a straitjacket and he's drowning. And I was like, oh, they could have just added a word or two, and it said, wouldn't you like to try to escape this life? And then it would have made more sense. But then he says, wouldn't you like to escape? Well, you put him in the box, he's going to escape. That's his wish, right? Like, you know what I mean? So I think that was sort of like a fail in the turn of phrase. But otherwise, I mean, I just thought it was really fun that I love that aspect of the character, that unless you ask him for something directly, he is not going to, you know, engage his magical powers.
No. And to that like note, like, did you notice, like, not only does he put this guy in the Houdini, you know, water torture escape box.
Yeah.
He has two spotlights that shine on the box. I
did not notice that.
So I'm like, how did he do that? Like, he took the specificity and the time to use magic to create two imaginary spotlights that weren't imaginary. But like, I'm like, man, that he really went for the details on that. Like, it is pretty interesting though how much havoc he absolutely reeks, and there's no news reports. There's no, like, I mean, you're talking about a string of people that either disappeared or wound up somewhere. I mean, a plane exploded. A whole plane exploded when the owner of the gem shop, you know, said he wanted $1 million, and Wishmaster was like, sure. Takes it from his own mom. As she signs, an insurance policy before she gets on a $1 million insurance policy before she gets on a plane that Wishmaster has blown up.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just some pretty wild, crazy stuff. I also felt this, Christian. I don't know if you were thinking this, but I almost felt like the movie is an interesting time capsule, because they did have some very, what you would call at this point, low-level CG vignettes in this, especially where he goes through the security guard. But it was almost as if someone had come to the director and Wes Craven and said, listen, in a few years, all your prosthetics and your real, like, plastic and gore effects, you're not going to be able to use them. So let's go to the warehouse now and get everything out of it and put it in every single scene we could find, because, you know, there was a lot of great makeup work in this thing.
Yeah.
And it goes by in seconds. I mean, you're talking about hours and hours and hours of really amazing physical, real makeup work and effects that just go right by.
Well, did you notice that Greg Nicotero is one of the makeup guys on this movie?
No, who is he?
He is on Walking Dead, and directs on Walking Dead. He's one of the producers. He does The Walking Dead. And this Kurtzman, the director, he's actually a big makeup effects guy.
Right.
So it makes sense that a lot of the... It's funny because when the djinn first turns into the sort of monster thing, the first thing that popped in my head was like, that's the Green Goblin. Like, he looks exactly like the Green Goblin. Like, I was, and I thought to myself, why didn't Sam Raimi just use that? You know what I mean? For the original Tobey Maguire Spider-Man movie. Because when he first appears and the head shows and the monster, and it's kind of, I remember it's sort of like a slightly slow reveal. And as soon as the monster face reveals itself, fully, I was like, that is the Green Goblin all the way.
And speaking of which, when he was first kind of, I guess, born into the world, that was the midget from, what's it called?
The little person from...
I'm sorry. The little person from...
Whatever.
I forgot his name, but he's in here. What was the general? Yeah, Vern Troyer, who was Yeah, he was totally in full on makeup, because remember in the beginning, Wishmaster's like a little baby Wishmaster.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
That first one was Vern Troyer, and it was really weird because you couldn't tell what Wishmaster was doing. It's like he was trying to merge with a guy and grow, and
he was
quite sickly in the beginning. He was very skinny.
That's right. Yeah. There's sort of like an embryonic phase to him when he first, which is it's really interesting. If you noticed, you mentioned earlier that there's all these like actors from other horror movies.
Right.
It's funny, when I was watching stuff, I noticed, and it says here on the Wikipedia, it confirmed it for me, there's a lot of like horror movie Easter eggs in there. For me, that embryonic phase was very, very similar to sort of like what Mars Attacks, you know, used for their alien, sort of like the alien with the brain and the skull. And I can't remember the exact movie. It's like Island Earth or This Island Earth. Maybe I'm thinking of the wrong thing, but you know, there's that design. And then there is a scene where they are in Robert Englund's collection of like ancient deity statues. And right in the corner, I noticed it because this is the horror movie that freaks me out all the time, is the statue of the demon that sort of takes over Linda Blair in The Exorcist.
Correct.
And then I believe... And I noticed it, like I was like, "Oh wow!" I mean, it wasn't like that it was sticking out, but like as it panned the room, I was like, "That's a statue from The Exorcist." I was like, "Holy cow! Holy cow!" It's like, I wonder if that's on purpose. Did somebody, you know? And it must have been on purpose. And then I noticed in the party in ancient Persia, when everyone was freaking out and being killed, there's like a chest burster in there, popping out of somebody's stomach.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, really? Like, it just swings by, it goes by him really fast, but I was like, oh, wow. And then I'm just wondering how much, you know, I missed, because there was a lot in there. There were a lot of, like, Easter eggs before you would even sort of regularly do that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's really like they were like, hey, this is for horror fans, by horror fans. And I think that's kind of what's so sweet about the movie in a way, is that it is unique and weird, but obviously everyone working on it loved horror, and that's you know, primarily where their careers were from. So I think when you have that kind of mix, even though the movie, you know, shows low ratings if you look at it now, it's enjoyable because people that made it, I think, really loved it. And we should do a brief recap of the plot, because it's amazing. I was actually telling Heidi on the walk, because I'm like, I got to tell you about Wishmaster, because she's like, what are you going to talk to Christian about? I go, we're talking about Wishmaster. And only Christian saw the movie, and no one else wanted to see this thing. So anyway, and just jump in if I get it wrong. So Robert Englund, who is basically he's a rare, you know, collector of rare antiquities. And
well, you got to start off in ancient Persia, man.
I do have to start off. All right. So the movie opens in ancient Persia, where there's just a party scene or getting ravaged. People are, I think, going ape because the king, it seems, had asked the Wishmaster that he wanted to see, what did he say, Marvels and Amazing Things or something.
Yeah, yeah.
So the Wishmaster's like, oh, to him, you know, Marvels and Amazing Things are like, you know, creatures crawling out of your chest cavity. So
yeah, yeah.
The Wishmaster unleashes just a crazy amount of carnage and death through this guy's, you know, party. And it seems there was, how would you describe that other gentleman? Was he like a person?
He was like a religious guy.
Like assistant to the.
A holy man or something.
Yeah, like a holy man. And he's like, and you're following this guy through this party until he finds the king on his throne with the Wishmaster beside him, kind of whispering into his ear.
Yeah.
And he somehow, I think this holy man summons the gem, correct?
Created the gem to trap the djinn. But
right.
Yeah, yeah. And then there's this whole thing that explains that, you know, that the light at the beginning of the universe gave birth to angels, you know, the earth gave birth to man, and the fire gave birth to the djinn, you know, and they were sort of condemned to dwell between earth and heaven and be these like other powerly creatures, otherworldly, you know, extremely powerful creatures that would roam the earth between earth and heaven or whatever the nether world, whatever you want to call it. And they would trick people into making three wishes. And then if you made a third wish, the djinn would be unleashed upon the world to wreak havoc, right?
Right. So like an army of djinn.
Somewhere there's a Green Lantern Corps, Lantern Corps of djinn somewhere.
And they almost got through because you see them sort of pulsating through the wall.
Yeah, because the king is about to make like a third wish, right?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. So the djinn is imprisoned. So the Wishmaster is imprisoned in this very rare and unique gem. And then we cut to, I think, present day, where Robert Englund is, they're at the docks. And he's so excited. He can't wait. He has a special package, you know, in your stock wooden shipping container. coming over, and you know, we see his assistant is yelling like, "Hey, you know, be careful with that thing. What are you doing?" Well, it turns out the guy operating the crane pours a little, you know, I would think some Jack Daniels into his coffee.
Some happy juice, yeah.
Some happy juice, but that causes him to like lose control of the crane. The coffee and rum gets, or whatever it is, gets all over the controls. And as Robert Englund's assistants, like barking orders, this statue just smushes the guy.
Yeah, yeah.
So like the djinn, without even being free, like is the bad omen that happens. So the statue inside the crate cracks open, and one of the construction workers on the site sees the gem that the genie is trapped in, and he just pockets that thing.
Yeah.
And
he just, without remorse, somebody just got smushed by this statue, and he just sees the gem, and
not even thinking like, I don't want to go near that thing, right? Yeah, like, this is a crime scene. Let me go over to the crime scene, and oh look, a gem. We find out he pawns it off at a pawn shop. At a pawn shop.
Not a smart guy.
No. And basically, I might be skipping a scene with the introduction of our heroine, but the owner of the pawn shop makes his way to the gem, what do you call this place? The gem assessment?
Well, it's
clinic.
It's like an appraisal house for ancient, for jewelry and relics and stuff like that.
So he walks in and explains, hey, I got this gem. I really want to know how much it's worth because I just pawned it. You know, I just whatever gave this guy some money, but I know it's worth more. And the owner of the gem appraisal place is a real kind of he's a douche, right? He's like a douchebag.
Yeah, he's kind of a dope, I would say.
I guess
he's
a
not
dope.
Like a jerk. He comes across like very much like, again, a very 90s sort of like dopey, maybe a little bit sleazy, but he doesn't, you know, hit on any women or anything like that.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, that's true. So he's the boss of our heroine.
Yeah. No, he's not the boss of our heroine.
Oh, he's not?
He is somebody that she knows. No, because our heroine works at Oh, does she work at that lab?
Yeah, she works at his lab.
Okay. I thought she worked at a different lab. I guess no. I'm getting her and her boyfriend's place confused.
Right, Tony, Josh Aikman, who is, I think, Tony Crane.
Okay.
Anyway, so she basically the gem is left for her to analyze at that point. And she can't really make out what the thing is, although she starts having flashes of the Wishmaster's face in her brain, right? And then she eventually hands it off to her boyfriend, who was playing. They were playing tennis earlier in the movie, and he works at like a university, so he's more of a scientific, I guess, type, and would really give her some details on this thing. Well, as we see this guy analyzing the gem, he somehow it shatters. Correct?
Yeah, yeah.
And he awakens the Wishmaster. And
he analyzes it with a laser or something, and that's an effect. Yeah,
and that was a great graphic, by the way.
Yeah, it was a neat little thing that kind of jumped out at you. Yeah, yeah.
So he breaks the gem, the Wishmaster's free, and then almost reborn into the modern day world as a small person.
Yes,
played by
sort of Mars Attacks looking creature.
Right, played by Vern Troyer, who was in I'm forgetting the name of the movie, but you know what movie he was in. He was Dr. Evil, Little Evil.
Austin Powers.
Right. He was in
Really? That's so funny. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so he's famous for Austin Powers. So then the Wishmaster is – I think he must take some energy from Tony Crane, who's Tammy's boyfriend, and he seems to grow a bit. He grows in almost to a skinny version of the Wishmaster. And then from there, Christian, what happens? We kind of, where does it go from there?
Well, so basically you sort of got the lead, you think he's going to be the lead guy, but he's not the lead guy. Her boyfriend, he gets killed.
He's done. Yeah.
Yeah. He gets killed he gets hurt in the explosion that the gem, you know, and basically mm-hmm. this is when you start to see the Wishmaster kind of, applying his manipulation, because he says, "Oh, would you like the pain to end or something?" Right. And the guy's like, "Yes, yes, I would like the pain to end." And of course, you know, then he dies. He basically, and so what ends up happening is Tammy Lauren, you know, comes because she's introduced in the movie in an earlier scene where she's playing tennis with her best friend who asks her out. And he says, we should actually go out on a date. And so you've got the whole, like, blah, blah, blah. Basically, he's in the friend zone. He's not getting out of the friend zone. She wants him to stay friends because I forget exactly what she says. I don't know if she's referring to the family fire or her ex-boyfriend, but she's basically saying, "I don't want to lose another important thing. You're too important for me." And he's like, "Oh, but we could go to dinner and a movie." Anyway, that's when they get introduced. And then there's this scene where he's analyzing the gem for her because she finds a flaw in it. And she's like, and her boss is like, "What? There's a flaw in the gem? You know, will that reduce its value?" And she's like, I don't know. I have to go to my friend who basically, I don't know, he's a scientist. They don't say what he does. But he analyzes the gem, blows up, just like you said. And then she comes running in. And she's like, "Oh my God, blah, blah, blah." And, you know, the cop is kind of like, you know, it's very 90s low budget, sort of like not super low budget, but low budget enough that the cop that's playing her is basically like, obviously did not complete his sensitivity training at the academy.
No, because, not at all.
Because she comes in and he basically like delivers to her the worst news possible that her, you know, best friend is dead, and it's just like, it's not a very good scene, the way that he kind of delivers it.
Oh, no. He said he's sorry, and that was that.
Yeah, yeah. And then, the djinn is sort of like on his way to create mischief, and he runs into a homeless guy outside of a pharmacy who gets harassed by the pharmacist, and then the djinn is sort of like, would you like something to happen to, or what was it? Oh, I hope, in the altercation, the homeless man says, "I hope you die and get cancer."
Because
let's face it though, the pharmacist was being a jerk.
Absolutely not a
jerk. Very nice guy. Well, I don't think you should die of cancer, but it's a very fast acting cancer. I don't know how it works because because as soon as the homeless man says, yeah, the pharmacist starts freaking out, and it's like almost like his skin is like boiling or whatever. He falls over and he dies. And then the homeless man has like a fit and freaks out and runs away. And basically that's sort of like the second scene where the djinn is sort of revealed as his fully formed self and what his deal is. And so for the rest of the movie, you've basically got Tammy Lauren trying to sort of figure out what the deal is with the gem, how her boyfriend got killed, what is going on, you know, in her life, while the djinn sort of tracks her down and she basically becomes his target through the whole movie. He's trying to track her down. And there's really no reason given for that, except for maybe the
Why has to track her down?
Why does she become his target?
Because she was the one, he was sensing that she was the one that originally woke him up.
But
so remember, she visits the occult expert, a woman at the university.
Yeah.
And she was saying he's got
that
a charge.
Was great. I loved her. The occult expert. Yeah.
Yeah. He's got to charge the stone. It's interesting that he has to put his own jail back together again by wishing. At least that's what I understood. He keeps doing all these little wishes on people, and he's building his powers. But the original, like, there's an original person, and I guess he assigned it to her, and that person is granted three wishes. Uh-huh. And on the third wish, that's when the djinns come through. All of them.
Interesting. How did I miss all that? Or I just don't remember.
I don't know how you might have just blacked out at that point. So
maybe.
I think when she was originally analyzing it, you know, he kind of like latched on to her and was like, hey, you just woke me up.
Or, you know, the writer was just like, hey, I need to have him follow this female protagonist during the movie. Good enough.
Right. Well, keep in mind, too, her boyfriend destroyed the stone.
Yeah, that's true.
And he was definitely after her as well. Remember, he took his life force or something. So, there, you know, even though it's vague and weird, I felt like it sort of held together. And I was like, okay, I still don't get why he has to fuse his own jail, because essentially him fusing his gem back together by getting more powerful is only, you know, only helping the good guys in that they could throw him back in that stone.
Yeah.
But in a way, you know, she didn't defeat him. She defeated him by outsmarting him with the third wish. So the third wish was granted, but it was so carefully planted by her that it reversed time. Because I think a great part of the movie, too,
that's
was when
the climax of the movie, the sort of final confrontation, which was kind of fun in its own way. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
We'll get probably more to that. But it was interesting when at one point he confronts the security guard because he's trying to find her address. And the security guard says, I want you to, you know, Wishmaster's like, what do you wish in his human form? And the security guard goes, I want you to go away. And the djinn has to go away.
Yeah.
And the security guard, to his fault, opens his mouth again.
Yes.
And brings the djinn out of that last command, and then allows the djinn to, I guess, the security guard got too cocky and said, hey, if you, you know, go away. He's like, oh, if you're going to come, you're going to have to go through me to get in here or something.
The security guard says, I would love to see that.
Right. I'd love to see that.
Joking around. So, and then it's like, oh, it's on. Like the
it's on. Yeah.
That was kind of a clever scene. I kind of enjoyed that. Yeah.
And that's what's so cool, though, about the djinn. It's that he does have weaknesses. He has like pretty glaring weaknesses if you could figure them out. And I think as a villain, you know, he's not only is he doomed to walk the netherworlds, and he's, you know, he's got to follow a freaking format where he's got to charge this and that. He's also vulnerable, you know, in ways that if you wish the right thing with the right combination of words, you'll get him. You could defeat him. I think that's another cool part of the movie where it's like he's defeatable. You just got to say the right thing.
Well, it's really funny because it's interesting because there's definitely an episode of the X-Files, sort of like later X-Files, that totally rips this thing off, like completely rips it off. Oh, yeah, big time. I mean, unless this show ripped the X-Files off, I'm not sure. I would have to look up the episode. Mm. But there's an episode where they meet a genie, and it's like, unless you wish for the specific sort of exact thing, your wish just takes you down like the wrong road, like something really terrible.
You know the name of that episode?
I can't remember the name of it. I should have looked it up before the podcast. But yeah, I remember that there's specific. But you know, X-Files was really good with that, where they would take sort of like the concept of an old horror movie or another horror movie and basically sort of like turn it on its head or use it within the context of the X-Files. You know, they did that sort of thing all the time. But when I started watching this, I thought, oh, this is very, and you know, if we're going to go back all the way, I mean, the Wishmaster is sort of like a take of the original, what is that short story, The Monkey's Paw, where it's like you make a wish and it's not, if it's not complete or, and the wish doesn't come out exactly the way you want it. As a matter of fact, most of the time it comes out horrible. And the Monkey's Paw is like a perfect example. You know, they wish for money and then their son gets killed or in an accident.
Right.
You know what I mean? And that's how they get the money. So, I mean, this is very much sort of all playing off of that. But I think, you know, I thought I was really not going to like this movie. But,
I know.
I mean, I really, and it's really funny to me because, you know, when I rented it on Amazon, the only options to rent it are standard definition. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
there's no high def version available of Wishmaster, at least streaming. I don't know if it's on Blu-ray or not. But it's funny to me that when I was looking it up to watch it, you know, for this episode, I was like, well, they made two sequels. There must be something decent about it, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was very, it's interesting. I find it to be sort of very middle of the road horror. It's not too extreme. It's not too terrible. I mean, I think it's something that like maybe a young teenager could watch, you know, and maybe they would get like maybe freaked out by it or afraid of it. But there's nothing like, there's no nudity in it, which is like really interesting to me. There's no soup.
No kissing.
I mean, there is gore.
There's a kiss at the end.
Yeah, there's no like big makeout scenes or anything like that. Like, there's none of that sort of like, it's interesting. There's none of that sort of the sexual undertones or whatever that run through other horror movies where it's like, oh, the first couple that has sex, you know, is basically the first one to die or anything like that.
There's
none of that. They don't play with any of that. It's just, it's funny because, I mean, I know that the reason that I liked it so much is because it is 90s all the way. Like, I was watching it, and I was like, it just reminded me of every 90s TV show that I watched. Every 90s, you know, I mean, it is 90s all the way. So I think that there's an aspect of, like, 90s nostalgia that hit me. I don't know that everyone would get the same mileage out of this movie that I did. But, you know, I found it enjoyable. I thought I was going to hate it, man. I really thought I was going to hate it. And I enjoyed it. I had a good time watching it.
Yeah, I think it's just one of those movies that I think, again, it's there's some really good artistry in there. And it's fun. And that's really all it is. It's not a complete waste of time at all. It's
nice, interesting because you say artistry and there is a lot of artistry in it. I mean, it's funny because it's sort of considered to be, I mean, I know that, you know, one of our other friends was like, yeah, Wishmaster's not my favorite. And, you know, I mean, I get that. Like I said, it's very middle of the road. It doesn't go too extreme in one direction or another, which is kind of like its fault. But I wonder if like some of the gore in this movie was considered it, because I mean, we've come a long way in 20 years. There's some crazy stuff in horror movies now. I'm wondering if this was considered, cause there's a scene, I think somebody's head gets blown up and you kind of see that and you see, there's like quick bursts of stuff, but now like this would be considered sort of like a quaint cable TV show. You know what I mean? Like you see worse stuff on Walking Dead every week or, you know, other stuff. But, I mean, I thought Tammy Lauren was pretty good. I love the guy who played the djinn. And I loved the sort of, well, it's funny that one scene sort of, is she a history professor or what was she? The one that she goes and gets information from?
Let's see. Was that Wendy Benson?
I'm not sure.
Or no,
exactly.
Jenny, I think it was Jenny O'Hara.
I'm not sure
Wendy
who it was.
Which,
oh yeah, Jenny O'Hara, that's her. Where they sort of almost insinuate that her character is a djinn as well, like when she's having that conversation. Didn't you catch that? Didn't you think that that she was sort of like when they were talking and she's like, "Well, what can I do for you? Like, how can I help you?" And she
you mean
like,
in the first time she talked to her?
No, the second time.
Well, that's because that was him, wasn't that the djinn?
Oh, that's right. Blanked out. Had a brain fart. Yep.
Yeah.
It's Monday,
I mean,
folks.
she works a lot too. She was just on Transparent.
She was a really good actress. As a matter of fact, I thought she was the most natural, best one in the whole cast. You know, I mean, if you were talking like somebody that you sort of believed on the screen that was very, you know, mixed in with, you know, because everyone else is sort of doing a performance
of a caricature.
Yeah. And she just seemed to sort of like really inhabit what she was doing. I really liked her performance a lot. It was really good.
Yeah, but it was interesting because when you got to that point, she kind of made it seem really real. Like, this isn't a joke. You know, they say, hey, all this stuff you've been watching, which feels like a weird joke. She's like, no, this is like, this guy's really crazy. Like, and you better respect what he's doing here or else, you know. It brought another dimension to the movie, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I when she was on screen, I was very much engaged, you know, and there, and you know, like we mentioned earlier, there may have been moments where I did zone out during an explanation or two.
Yeah.
But, you know, to just make a comment on that, I mean, you know, if we're really, and I keep saying, you know, I need to stop doing that, but if you look at this movie from a completely objective viewpoint, yes, it is sort of flat. It does look sort of, there's not a lot of super interesting camera angles. There's not a lot of super interesting setups. There aren't really like hugely compelling scenes, but this is very fun middle of the road movie. I mean, it's not too crazy. It's not too boring. It's sort of like Goldilocks's porridge. It's just right. And I don't think there's anything really wrong with that.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree.
Yeah,
But yeah, I mean, we should probably leave the ending a little bit open ended in case people want to check it out. There's still plenty in there that we didn't mention.
It's a pretty good ending. I mean, we don't have to say exactly what happens, but I do like sort of how the heroine gets herself out of being under the djinn's thumb, as it were.
Yeah.
It's a very sort of clever turn of events.
Yep, I am tempted to watch Wishmaster 2 at this point.
Wishmaster 2.
Just got to find the right time. But yeah, he does return, so you would think it's interesting because he doesn't come back in part 3, and I don't think he comes back in 4. But he did come back for part 2, so...
It's interesting to me... Just when something just became a success like that in the late 90s, it's like, well, got to do another one. Well, got to, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, obviously, this movie made almost 3 times its budget. It looks like, according to Wikipedia, it made $6 million in one weekend. Which
amazing.
That to me is amazing. The fact that a movie like this, and I guess it looks like, according to Wikipedia, it was against In and Out. Like, that was, like, one of the movies.
Oh, wow.
And The Game, the Michael Douglas movie, The Game, Fincher.
Oh, so, yeah, I love The Game.
It's, like, one of my favorite. Yeah. Blew me away when I saw it in the theaters. But to think that this came out at the same time as those two movies and came in 3rd at the box office is mind-boggling.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
It's a whole other, like, let's be honest, it's a whole other level of filmmaking than those two films. Like, those two movies are sort of great levels of craft. And this is sort of like, yeah, okay, you know, we're going to make a horror movie. And there's good craft in there, but it's not the it ain't The Shining or The Exorcist or, you know, that sort of thing.
Well, what's interesting, Chris, no, you're totally right. But what's interesting about, I was looking at part two here, Wishmaster part two, called Evil Never Dies.
Apparently not.
The writer is Peter Atkins.
Yeah, again. Same writer. Oh, great.
And we have the same Wishmaster.
Yes.
Andrew Devov, is that right? Devov? And now if we go to Wishmaster 3, Beyond the Gates of Hell, again, the writer is Peter Atkins, directed by Chris Angel. I don't know if that's the same Chris Angel.
That can't be. The magician guy?
No, it's not the magician. No. I don't think so.
No, I don't think so.
No. And then if we go to... Actually, I was going to check who directed part two, Evil Never Dies. So the director's Jack Shoulder, who I don't know. I don't know who that is.
They have Wishmaster 4, too.
Yeah, I think you misspoke when you said... No, there's four total Wishmasters.
Okay.
So the director of Wishmaster 2 is known for... A Nightmare on Elm Street 2, and The Hidden, and Wishmaster 2. Okay. And he's from Philadelphia, which is interesting. So I don't know what that... Yeah.
Wishmaster 3 stars the son of Sean Connery, Jason Connery. Now we have to see it. I didn't even know he had a son that was an actor.
And then you have Wishmaster 4, Prophecy Fulfilled. Again... Written by Peter Atkins, and Chris Angel comes back to reprise his directorial roles. So there's a lot of Wishmaster here, Christian.
There is a lot of Wishmaster, but it's really funny as you go through them on Internet Movie Database, Wishmaster 3, 3.6, Wishmaster 4, slightly better at a 4.0.
Really?
Yeah, Wishmaster 4 gets a 4.0. Which is very fitting because it is Wishmaster 4. So, but it's interesting if there's, we talked, when we were talking about a Prince of Darkness, I mean, I really think you could remake this and do something really interesting with Wishmaster. I think it would
really,
I think you could totally, or bring it back or do a sequel. I mean, you know, why not? I mean, properties are sitting around. There were three sequels. Obviously it was popular at some point. Obviously it was popular enough that when you mentioned it, I knew what it was. I didn't have a positive, relationship to it when you mentioned it, but at least, you know, I was like, oh, I know what Wishmaster is. So I'm really surprised that 20 years later, nobody's sort of tried to do something with this property. I would really love to see, or I think you could do a pretty decent remake. I mean, I think you would have to get a really, really smart writer to sort of turn it on its head and make the Wish aspect a little more clever. But I think you could, the time could be ripe for another Wishmaster movie.
Wow. Hey,
man, it's almost been something like, let me see, Wishmaster 4, 2002. So 5 years from now, it'll be time for another Wishmaster. I mean, this year is the 20-year anniversary of Wishmaster. Why wouldn't you do it?
Oh, wow. Yeah. Wowee.
Yeah.
That's amazing. We're going to have to watch 2, 3, and 4 and see where 4 ends off.
Yeah, I don't know if I have time.
Maybe do a Kickstarter, and then you can direct a Wishmaster 5.
Get the rights from Wes Craven's estate. See if he'll let us do. I'm surprised nobody's. I mean, this is a property. You know, have they ever made Wishmaster comics? I mean, it just seems like so many people are mining so many properties that are laying around. I'm surprised that nobody's tried to bring it back.
I don't know. It's amazing. It could be a good comic. It could be a great cartoon.
Yeah.
You know, Wishmaster action figure, which I should probably look up right now.
There you go.
Yeah.
Does it exist? Are you finding it?
I don't know. I'm going to find it out. Yeah. Someone searched for it already. Let's see. Well, no, he's out there. Oh, it's beautiful. It's by McFarlane Toys.
Really?
See? Wow. Beautiful.
There you go.
Beautiful, too.
Are you going to buy it?
No. No. I mean, I love the Wishmaster. I mean, maybe if I get through the others, there's some on eBay. unfortunately. There looks like to be one at Walmart here. But this is an interesting version of the Wishmaster.
Oh, maybe it's sort of one of the later movies or something.
It could be.
I know what I'm going to get Ian for Hanukkah.
Please, scare the hell out of Max. I got to say, though, the McFarlane toy looks pretty good of the Wishmaster.
Well, McFarlane always does a great job with his action figures. I don't know if he's still making action figures, but he did once upon a time, and they were great.
Yeah. Well,
cool. So any final thoughts on Wishmaster?
What else could we say about Wishmaster? I think it's just a good, fun movie for the Halloween season. And I hope more people can come to it like you did, doubting it, being skeptical, but then realizing that Wishmaster ultimately is your friend.
Well, I don't know if he's your friend, but it's definitely I can't say that. I mean, what I would recommend it for is for people who want to watch something scary but don't want it too scary. You know what I mean? Or want to show something to their teenagers that can handle a little bit of gore. Maybe like, I don't know, you know, God, you know, people are bringing their kids into horrible movies, you know, so I don't know, but maybe a 15, 16-year-old sort of thing, because I do think that the female protagonist is a positive female protagonist. I think she's smart. I think she has agency. I think, you know, she moves the plot forward and she actually fights for what she needs to fight for, and she's smart. So I think that there's some positive things in there for maybe young female horror fans.
Absolutely. I think too, if you're a fan of, you know, real effects, if you're a fan of physical effects, practical CG, great makeup, and if you're just a horror fan and you're into Easter eggs and crossovers and cameos, you're gonna find a lot of fun stuff in Wishmaster.
And the other thing too is it's not exploitative. There is no sort of, again, I mentioned there is no nudity. There's no sort of female exploitation. I actually think it's a very sort of, for lack of a better term, girl power horror movie.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you have a central female character who, I mean, she is a good role model. For God's sake, she teaches basketball to young girls. I mean, it's a great touch, and you can tell that the writer sort of gave it some thought there. So good job on you, Peter Atkins. That's what I think. I mean, it's funny because we've gone over three horror movies, and horror movies have a reputation for, you know, exploitation and stuff like that. And the last three horror movies that we've watched haven't had any of that, you know? And that's kind of like a good trend. I don't know where things are going to go from here. We've got, I think, two more horror movies to look over. But I think that at least these first three, it's funny. They're gory. Yeah, they're kind of scary. The Haunting is just a work of genius. But in these first three, there hasn't been any sort of like sexual exploitation. And I find that really interesting because horror movies have a reputation for that.
Yeah.
And these three didn't have any of that. So, yeah, very cool. Cool. Excellent. Good pick, Ian.
Thanks, man. I'm glad we got to do it.
I'm glad I watched it. I don't know if my wife was glad we watched it, but I was glad I watched it. I enjoyed it. And again, another recommendation for if you're looking sort of something that hits that 90s nostalgia button, and if you're sort of around our age, you know what that means. And that's another reason to sort of watch Wishmaster. So, I think that's it. I think we've got a... We've kind of nailed everything we're going to nail in this episode about Wishmaster. Cool. Well, thank you for joining us, Ian Scheller. It's always great to have you on the podcast.
A true pleasure. A true pleasure.
I love talking to you. And my name is Christian Horn, and this is the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. And we have been chatting about, well, it says Wes Craven's Wishmaster, but, you know, it's really Robert Kurtzman's Wishmaster. Come on. this episode. And again, the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. Follow us on Twitter. Check us out on Facebook, Instagram. Leave us reviews on iTunes. You know, send us an email at ptf@parttimefanboy.com and all that good social media connectivity stuff that we've got to say at the end of each episode. Thanks for listening, and we will be back next week with another horror movie on Part-Time Fanboy. Part-time, what do you wish? Just like you said. All right. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Spare me, child. Behold my true face.
Oh, my God.
Yes. The shit just hit the fan, didn't it? Let's get this over with, shall we? Make your wishes. Three wishes, Alexandra. Doesn't that intrigue you? Just a little. Anything you want.
Anything?
You ask for anything. I must grant it. A trip to the moon. A visit to Pharaoh's Egypt.
What happened if I wished you dead?
Why, how remarkably original, Alexandra. I'll tell you what. I'll give you one free wish. A sample. Get you into the spirit of the game.
All right. I want you to destroy yourself. Blow your brains out. Right now.
Very well. That which is eternal cannot die. But if it's any consolation, sweet Alex, that hurt like hell. Now, make your three wishes.
Part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
I do it part-time.